Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. Today, my guest is Dr. Nathan Goodman. Nathan is a senior fellow at the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Previously, he was a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Economics at New York University, where he was affiliated with the program on the foundations of market economy. He earned his PhD in economics at George Mason University, and he was a PhD fellow with the Mercatus Center. In this episode, we talk about Nathan's recent paper on climate migration and how different forms of governance will change the way we enable climate refugees. So without further ado, let's dive right in. Hello, Nathan. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, Nathan, you work for the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Tell me more about the kind of work that you do. You're a research fellow there, and I know you work on a lot of different things, but would love to hear more from you.
Yeah, so my position is specifically within our academic and student programs team. And so I know you've interviewed some of my colleagues who are on other teams, like Shruti Rajagopalan, for example. And I work more on the side where we offer academic and student programs that are training people like myself and Shruti. So both Shruti and I are alums of the PhD fellowship program, for example, which is a program that we run for graduate students at George Mason University. We also have a variety of external fellowships like the Adam Smith Fellows Program, the Bastiat Fellows Program, the Eleanor Ostrom Fellows, and all of these are fellowships for students at other universities who are pursuing graduate studies, or if you're pursuing undergraduate studies, we have the Don LaVoy Fellowship. But in any case, we have all these academic and student fellowships where students explore ideas related to political economy. So ideas related to the incentives people face, the institutions and rules that govern people's lives, and how those shape the incentives and knowledge that people can access, and how people adapt and flourish under different conditions. And so that's really the core of what the team that I'm on does, is we have these academic and student programs, and people who are senior fellows like myself, in addition to serving as scholar participants in those fellowship programs, we also do our own academic research. And so the sort of core through line in my academic research is an interest in questions about governance and what it means for there to be a self-governing society. And I'm especially interested also in issues surrounding militarization and how the types of centralization of power that militarization causes might generate perverse incentives that could harm processes of bottom-up social cooperation and self-governance. And so that's kind of the overarching through line in a lot of my research agenda, is I have these buckets of research that are related to studying how people cooperate from the bottom up in contexts like markets and civil society and religious organizations. And then I also have a set of research projects related to things like militarization and how public-facing bureaucracies that are empowered to use violence to coerce people might generate certain types of patterns of incentives and might alter what kind of knowledge people have the ability to use and so on. And the paper that we're going to talk about today is sort of at the intersection of these two research programs, because I'm directly contrasting, alongside my co-author Eustace Enninga, who's actually a alum of our Adam Smith Fellows Program, the two of us are contrasting more polycentric, and we can talk about what that means, but it basically means people have many centers of decision-making that are autonomous from one another, right? We're contrasting these more polycentric ways of dealing with adapting to climate change, including adapting by migrating. And we're contrasting that with more monocentric approaches in which officials within a centralized government have the power to dictate to large swaths of people what they're supposed to do without those people having all that much autonomy. So that's kind of the gist of my overarching research agenda, is these two buckets: bottom-up forms of social cooperation and governance, contrasted with certain top-down systems of social control, and then sometimes I talk about the interactions between those.
Yeah, you talk about centralization or polycentric and monocentric governments, and also you mentioned that you have deep interest in why some things are militarized, right? Is there a specific reason why that you got into these fields? Any personal experience?
Yeah, so I mean, it's hard to say exactly. There's a variety of factors that were influential on my interest in this. When I was growing up, it was during the sort of early 2000s was when I was in middle school and high school, right? So George W. Bush was president at the time. The war on terror was a big topic. And so some of my formative political experiences related to being disturbed by certain things that the United States government was doing in terms of militarization, getting somewhat hopeful when Barack Obama was elected that that would end, noticing, oh, well, even if, say, the troop presence in Iraq has gone down, we're still doing extrajudicial killing using unmanned aerial vehicles or drones. There's still a pretty massive national security state that was undermining civil liberties. And so realizing, okay, so it's not just a matter of who the person is who's in charge. It seems like there's probably underlying institutional tendencies that might be fueling this militarization. And so trying to figure out what those institutional incentives that might be fueling those types of problems were got me interested in reading pretty widely. And I found that the explanations from a school of thought called public choice theory, which tries to model behavior of individuals within the political process the same way roughly that economists would model the behavior of individuals within market processes. So focusing on how people have their own individual goals and they respond to incentives that are shaped by the rules around them and that shapes the payoffs they face. And so for instance, the fact that a president wants to get reelected, the fact that a president has a very broad discretionary scope of power, and some of the ways in which the public tends to respond to high profile events like terrorist attacks, some of the ways that interest groups like defense contractors might influence things. All these factors lead to a set of patterns of incentives that give rise to these issues of militarization, centralized power, and civil liberties violations that were really some of the things that I was trying to understand when I was when I was younger, right? So when I was a high school student, a college student, and so on. And so I wasn't initially an economics major in college. I was a math major who was initially, when it came to taking social science courses, I was taking courses in political science. I was taking courses in sociology. I was taking courses in anthropology and so on, because it was these questions that people don't usually think of as economic that were kind of driving me at that point in time. And then at some point I wound up picking up some economics research by scholars like Robert Higgs, Chris Coyne, David Scarbeck, Dan D'Amico, other people who were using economics to analyze some of the more coercive aspects of state power. And I found that really fascinating. And that was really what drew me to studying economics. There are other aspects of things that contributed, but those were some of the major factors.
Yeah, you touched upon the fact that the whole war on terror is what kind of inspired you to take up this topic and to read more. I was talking to another guest yesterday, and the topic of conversation was about semiconductor supremacy. Mm-hmm. And with China and US and Taiwan and all these countries fighting for semiconductor supremacy. And we were discussing a book called War on Chips, which was authored by Chris Miller, professor of history at Tufts University. And the guest was talking about, well, the guest was not Chris Miller. It was Pranay Kotasthane, who also reads a lot on this in this field. But the thing that he mentioned was very interesting, is that it's not technically a war. Like the war on terror, the war on chips is not technically a war. But then the narrative is what is more important, right? When you say war, then it creates this sort of a propaganda. It's kind of a propaganda where it creates this impression that, hey, you know, someone at the leadership is doing something that is good for us. So it's fascinating that you mention it in this conversation, because it was kind of like a deja vu moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think you're absolutely right about the rhetorical and expressive role that naming things the war on whatever you're trying to say you're fighting plays, right? So Dan D'Amico, who is an economist at Wabash College, who was very influential on me, likes to say, America is very good at declaring war on abstract nouns. And
there's also I love very, that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. What a statement.
Yeah.
That is so true, though, when you think about it, right? Yeah. I can't think of other examples, but yeah, war on terror, war on chips.
Yep. War on drugs.
War on drugs. Yeah.
Yep. War on crime.
That makes total sense now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, excellent. Nathan, we are here to talk about obviously climate change and migration, and I want to refer to your paper extensively in this conversation. Paper released in July 2023, Adapting to Climate Change Through Migration. Before diving deep into the migration aspect of it, I mean, climate change, it's a reality. I think we are all learning to live with it. But I learned a very interesting statistic that in 2022, apparently nearly 10% of US homes were impacted by natural hazards.
Oh, wow.
With high climate risk, and it is growing year by year. And apparently people who are planning on buying a home are deciding where to purchase a home depending on climate change and areas that are heating up. And it was a report by NPR, and it concludes by saying that the southeast of the US is going to be the worst hit. And, in, let's say, 10 to 15 years, drought will slam the Colorado River and the reliant areas. So, yeah, pretty significant amount of change that we are going to see in the years to come. It also points out that cities like New Orleans and Houston will flood, and the Northeast is going to see more floods. I think we are starting to see with New York. During your research for the paper, did you notice any of these trends? Did you look at climate change from a non-public policy view? And what were your findings?
Yeah, so I will say that a lot of the more specific research on climate change was handled by my co-author Eustace Eninga, because Eustace Eninga he's a PhD student at King's College London. He was visiting at NYU when I was there as a postdoc, and so that's how we met. But he is a specialist on environmental economics and green political economy, so he knows the particulars of climate change to a greater extent than I do. So I want to preface it with that, because there's often this division of labor within research where one co-author is bringing one set of literature, in my case a lot of the stuff around militarization and immigration policy and so on, and he's bringing more of the environmental side to it. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of really interesting literature on this for stuff that's going over what the wide swath of the literature says. There's some there's of course very interesting stuff in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. So if you, for example, look at some of their summaries of the findings for policymakers, one thing they state that they have very high confidence in is that the impacts are going to be geographically heterogeneous, which basically just means some places are going to be hit harder than others. And so that's going to be very important for both the kinds of things that you were talking about in terms of people choosing where to live within a jurisdiction like the US, where they have pretty wide freedom to choose where to live, right? Within the US, it's not as though I need to get permission to move from Virginia to New York and back again, right? Whereas if you want to get permission to move from India to the United States, you need to get permission from a bureaucrat. And so the relevant thing here is there's this heterogeneity in who's impacted. And we see this in the IPCC report, as I said. We see this mentioned in some work published in journals like Nature Climate Change that focuses on this concept of the human climate niche, the idea that there are certain temperature ranges that people are more able to flourish in than others. And there are certain areas like the Sahara Desert that are currently what they call hot zones, right? Their temperatures are above this human climate niche. And basically, as we discussed at the beginning of the paper, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but they're predicting, and admittedly, this is based on some of the more pessimistic climate models, because we have climate models for various levels of mitigation expectations, right?
Yeah, I think I have the
larger proportion will be.
I think I have the number in front of me. So I think 1% of Earth's surface is a hot zone now, but that could grow to about 20% by 2070. Is what it says? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So that's a situation where a large number of people are going to be in a situation that is much worse for them unless they move, right? And so people having relatively more freedom to choose where they live allows for more adaptation based on our expectations, right? If people expect this type of change to occur, they're going to adapt and revise their plans. As you noted, people in the US are already doing that when they choose where to purchase a home. And so it's important for people in places that currently are locked out from some of that level of choice because, say, they live in a relatively small jurisdiction and immigration restrictions restrict their freedom of movement away from a region that is likely to become a hot zone or is likely to face more severe natural disasters. Currently, they're restricted from adapting their plans to take into account the new types of climate risk. There's also research from within economics on the heterogeneous effects of climate change, the geographically heterogeneous effects of climate change. Mm-hmm. So there was a recent NBER working paper on this that I think we cite in the paper, for example. So it's coming from a range of disciplines. There's climate scientists who are pointing this out. There's social scientists who are pointing this out. There's journalistic reports on it, as you noted, with the NPR report that you were referencing. And so it's definitely something that we're seeing and that people who are studying this from a wide range of perspectives are finding.
Yeah, it was so interesting to see that Phoenix, the city of Phoenix, is seeing rapid growth. I think it has grown multifold. And the fun fact is that Phoenix was not even a very popular city back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And then air conditioning came, and then people were comfortable moving and living in a city like Phoenix. And then home buying prices were pretty low compared to, say, a California or New York, and people start to flood in. And now a city like Phoenix, especially the metro area, is seeing some of the highest U.S. population growth rate and also a lot of heat-related deaths. And the NPR report goes on to find that the riskiest counties include coastal Carolina and Louisiana and Florida. I think Louisiana, people would expect because of, year after year, we see hurricanes and whatnot. But Carolina was quite a surprise. And they even say that Beaufort County in South Carolina will be the single riskiest place, according to the study. So very, very fascinating. And yeah, Southeast will be affected is what they say. Interesting findings. I mean, it quite surprised me. I thought California, Louisiana, Florida would be in the list.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see because it's not always what you would initially expect. And it's also just the case that there's so much that's a matter of local context but related to environmental conditions. And so it can be hard to know when there's so many different types of communities in the US, what's going to be a community that's hit hardest by these sorts of things, especially since there's also a range of different types of climate risk, right? There's the types of heat deaths that people are experiencing in Phoenix are going to be a different type of risk than the risk from a hurricane in Louisiana, for example, but they're both climate change related risks.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. So your paper primarily focused, especially you as a co-author of the paper, primarily focused on the migration aspect. Give me a 101 about climate migration, why that happens. I mean, we know why that happens, but more like, what are the places around the earth where this is happening more in numbers? One of the notable mentions is what's happening in Bangladesh, Myanmar, that part of the planet. Also, I was talking to this rural reporter called Parth MN, who reports rural India. And he was telling that parts of central India is extremely affected by climate change, and that the farmers are not able to predict when the rains would come, how much is it going to rain, and so on. And it's affecting their planning. It's not really migration, but it is affecting their economic aspect and all that. So, um, So give me a sense of where this is more, the climate migration is more.
Yeah, so this is something that we should probably, so we're currently revising the paper for submission to a journal, because this is a working paper that we released with the Center for Growth and Opportunity. So this is something where, to get the precise numbers, I should actually look into it more than I have. I was largely drawing on the kind of high level, the overarching literature, which tends to, a lot of which tends to speak in kind of generalities rather than the quantitative magnitudes. And I also would not want to necessarily say that the existing trends are likely to remain the same. But you're absolutely right that we see some of this in Bangladesh and India. It's something that we also see reports in Central America, right? So there's an NPR piece that discussed how a farmer named Francis Perez, whose family owned like a coffee plantation, was planning to migrate to the U.S. because changes in weather events of the sort that you were describing were also adversely impacting the ability to maintain a coffee plantation. So this is something where I don't actually off the top of my head know the numbers, and so I want to be upfront about that. And I also would be hesitant to simply from existing trends assume that climate migration is going to be the same in the future. Now, one thing that is something that's mentioned repeatedly throughout the literature is that, you know, you might often think of climate migration as people moving from just from, you know, countries in the global south or from relatively poor countries to like Europe and the US. And that's not the bulk of climate related migration. The bulk of climate migration is somewhat more local. It's occurring within regions rather than vastly across regions, right? That doesn't mean that that'll necessarily stay the same way in the future. Obviously, we can't know the future. And it's important to have policies that allow people to use their local knowledge and to adapt and act on their own expectations rather than the expectations that we've drawn from past data necessarily, right? Because other people might know what they want better than you or I would. But it's something where we're seeing it from a variety of regions, and a lot of it is within region rather than totally, you know, moving all the way across the world in some sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. So now talking about climate change, as you resonate in the paper, climate change will impact the global south more. And like you mentioned, it's probably going to be Latin America that's going to be affected a lot more than others, and maybe Africa as well. How important is it for countries in the global north to sort of start thinking about accommodating these migrants from a central public policy standpoint?
Yeah, so I think that how much needs to be done at the level of public policy, one, it depends on your normative premises, right? So how much you weight certain values and value judgments. So ultimately, some of this comes down to value judgments in a way that an economist can't necessarily give you an answer to what should be done. We can simply tell you tendencies that are likely to happen based on our knowledge of social science. But what I will say is that I think my biggest concern is not necessarily that public officials within wealthy countries are doing too much or too little, but that they're focused on the wrong aspects of it in a way that is likely to generate harms. And what I mean by this is a large number of policymakers in the US and to some extent in the EU as well, think about climate migration principally as a security threat. And so and part of this might be a matter of attempting to engage in political rhetoric that's persuasive to the other side, right? If you're a Democrat and you want to convince a typical conservative to care about climate change, you might be more likely to get them on board, you'd think, if you frame it in terms of national security than if you frame it in terms of something that's already kind of left-coded, like environmental issues or humanitarian issues, right? And so some of it might be a matter of political strategy in terms of why public officials are framing it like that. It's also simply the case that some of that might be a matter of what people's jobs are, right? So a lot of the people who are putting together reports related to climate change are working for places like the Department of Defense, right? So their focus is national security, right? That's their job. And so they might care about other aspects of the issue, but their job is to assess it from a security standpoint. But regardless of the particular reason why there's this focus on the security angle, the danger I worry about from that security angle is that when we think about security issues, as I mentioned earlier, that tends to channel our attention towards more centralized approaches to dealing with the problem. So in this case, the focus would likely be on things like, all right, how can we have the Border Patrol, the Coast Guard, and other elements of the Department of Homeland Security get involved in a way that restricts those migrant inflows so that they don't become disruptive? It seems to be a lot of the types of questions that people are asking. And I think that when you ask the question with that as your point of orientation, the problem that is likely to emerge is that you're going to have people with centralized power and who lack access to relevant local knowledge directing large amounts of resources towards restricting people's ability to engage in adaptations that are likely to be beneficial for themselves and to be mutually beneficial for others. So what do I mean by that? Well, when immigrants come to the United States or when they come to any other country, they will often do things that benefit people who are already residents of those countries. So they will get jobs, for example, and the labor that they're providing is valued by their employer more than the amount that the employer is paying, because that's otherwise the employer wouldn't pay them, right? Similarly, they might start businesses. A lot of immigrants become entrepreneurs, and that produces products and services that citizens of the country that the immigrant moved to value. And so these types of processes where people make agreements with others in the private sector, that is a type of process that happens from the bottom up and can't be planned in advance by any policymaker. And so I think the worry that I have is that policymakers right now are focused so much on planning for climate migration from a standpoint that emphasizes using physical force to stop flows of migration and to slow down flows of migration. And that is going to mean that individuals who don't actually know what types of value-added interactions migrants can have with residents of receiving countries, allocating a large amount of resources to stop those interactions in a way that makes both prospective migrants and citizens of the country that the migrants might come to, as well as people who stay in the places the migrants are coming from, because of course remittances can be very helpful. It's going to harm these types of bottom-up interactions. And so I think that when we think about adaptation to climate change-induced migration, we should think about it less from just the perspective of what can policymakers do, and more from the perspective of what are people likely to do within the private sector? What are people likely to do within civil society? What are people likely to do within communities? What's likely to happen within families, whether that's people moving in with members of their family, people sending remittances home, people sharing information with their family members about where there might be opportunities, right? Those types of processes are just as important as public policies. And I think that public policies should be shaped in such a way that they allow space for those types of bottom-up processes to work. And so that's really where I think that the focus should be is, all right, where are these bottom-up processes likely to work? Where is policy getting in the way of these bottom-up processes? And are there cases where these bottom-up processes are likely to not be sufficient to adapt? And in those cases, what can policymakers do, if anything, to improve on those outcomes? But if the focus is instead on treating climate, assuming that people who are moving due to climate change are a threat, then we're likely to unduly hamper those bottom-up processes in a way that I would expect to increase the human costs of climate change, both for the prospective migrants who are prevented from leaving areas that are very, that are becoming inhospitable for them to live in, but also for everyone else, because one of the harms of climate change, of course, is say people who are in agriculture, as you said, become unable to plan, and so they can't produce as much, but there might be productive opportunities across a border that they could reach, and then they're producing things that other people around the world benefit from, but they might be stopped from seeking out that opportunity, And so everybody else gets poorer as a result. So that's how I think about adaptation, is not just what can policymakers do, but what do people in markets and civil society have incentives to do? What are they likely to discover? And are there barriers to them discovering that?
Yeah, it is. It's known that, you know, migrants, when they move and mingle with the society, they create a lot of value by performing jobs and services that will benefit the society that existed before they came in, right? And now we are talking at a very interesting time where a lot of conservative leaders are getting elected. Again, this is not pertaining to the paper, essentially, but I just wanted to get an idea of what you think. So more and more countries are going towards right-wing governments, and immigration is a problem, is a huge problem in the US, and we all are seeing what's happening at the southern border. But what I wanted to know is, should climate refugees treated differently than other refugees? Should they be taken care of with a little more empathy? What is your take on that?
So it's a good question. It's something where, again, because it's a normative question, economics alone can't answer it. I think that there are benefits and costs to thinking of it as a refugee issue. So one benefit to thinking of it as a refugee issue is that it may result in people having the opportunity to move who otherwise wouldn't. So it provides a potential political status. One downside is that the refugee framing historically has a particular meaning related to fearing violent repression from someone. And so something that's a harm caused by the physical environment is a different type of harm. And so it's a real harm, but it's something that framing it in those terms raises an interesting set of legal questions about how we're altering the scope of refugee law. And then the other big downside that I see to just framing it in terms of refugee status is that a refugee frames things around just a charity type logic, right? So the idea is, these are people in need and we need to help them. And that can result in people orienting themselves towards a zero-sum way of thinking about it. We're trying to help these people, so we're doing this out of the goodness of our hearts. Whereas I often think of immigration as, it's instead people making agreements with one another from the bottom up voluntarily. And the question is not, are we going to help them, right? Like it's some charity we're extending them. Instead, coercively interfering with their movement is a direct, affirmative, coercive act. It's not giving charity. It's more akin to if, while you're on the way to work, someone held you up at gunpoint and said, hey, you can't go to work unless you fill out 5 forms and wait 5 years or whatever, right? And in the meantime, I'm going to hold you here, right? Like that would be something where if it wasn't a national border that was doing that, we would look at it as quite odd. And so my attitude towards migration restrictions is, they're a coercive restriction on people engaging in free agreements with one another. They're a restriction on voluntary association. And so while I think it's true that there are humanitarian reasons that we should make sure that we are welcoming to people who are fleeing civil war, or fleeing human rights abuses, or fleeing natural disasters, or even seeking economic opportunities, right? I don't necessarily, in my mind, make as sharp of a distinction between refugees and economic migrants as some people do, but I know that it's a category legally where there's important distinctions under current system. But to me, in all these cases, it's people seeking a better life and leaving bad conditions and moving to conditions that they at least ex ante anticipate being better. And people don't get to, in my view, legitimately coercively interfere with that. And when they do, they better have a really good reason. And I think most of the time they don't have a really good reason. Now, so I tend to think of climate migration as just a subset of broader migration. So then the question arises, well, why did you focus this paper on climate migration if the issues that you're talking about are present with all other forms of migration for the most part? And that's a fair question. It was one that we got a lot when we initially presented it at conferences. And the way we framed it in the intro to the paper is that because climate migration is a new and salient issue, and it's one where there's not a clear set of categories in international law, as you know. Like there are people who would like to frame it as a refugee rights issue, and I think there would be some benefits to that insofar as it could use existing legal frameworks to allow for a greater scope of freedom of movement here. And it is true that people are fleeing some very bad conditions, much like other types of refugees. But because the legal status is in flux, right, it's not clear what the relevant laws and policies are going to be because it's a relatively new issue. I think it's important for people who have a strong understanding of the relevant social science around immigration, as well as of the ethical issues surrounding immigration, to point out how these issues apply in this context, even if some of the general points that we make are applicable in other contexts of immigration as well. I'm sorry if that was a long-winded answer that didn't necessarily quite get at your question, simply because I'm myself uncertain on the refugee status aspect of it. Don Shahar has a book chapter arguing against a refugee framing around it that's going to be coming out in an edited volume soon, and it's a very interesting chapter. He's a philosopher who does environmental ethics type issues.
No, I think that makes sense because, you know, we are all figuring it out together, right? Climate change is a new issue. We have been talking about it for quite some time, but I think more action is being taken in the last, you know, 7 to 8 years. And climate migration, as a result, is also a new issue. So we are all figuring it out together. So nobody nobody has the right long-term answers as of now. And that's fair. Nathan, I know you mentioned a bit about this top-down versus bottom-up approach. Mm-hmm. And in your paper, you discuss extensively about polycentric versus monocentric approaches pertaining to climate migration. Could you break down these two systems and how is one beneficial than the other?
Yeah, so the basic idea of polycentricity, we can trace it back to work by a scientist, a philosopher, but Michael Polanyi. He has books like The Republic of Science and The Logic of Liberty. And he wrote about polycentricity and applied it to issues like the scientific community. So if you think about the scientific community, right, it's not as though anyone is the commander-in-chief of science, right, or even of any subfield. It's not as though I get to be the commander of public choice economics and say, you go do research on this, you go do the research on that. What, you're doing research on this? You didn't get my permission to do that. No, everybody has freedom to research the topics that interest them. They can voluntarily associate into labs or academic departments. They submit to academic journals. There's relatively free entry in terms of people can start new academic journals if they're dissatisfied with the old ones. Those compete along margins of reputation, impact factor, credibility. There's a peer review process where when you submit an article to a journal, other scholars from relevant disciplines are going to critique your work. And so there's not any central authority within that. Instead, it's a bottom-up process of cooperation among research collaborators and contestation, both within the peer review process and afterwards through individual researchers critiquing, responding to, trying to replicate, building off of one another's work. And so this is a process that, rather than emanating from any top-down plan, right, any scientific authority saying, all right, guys, now we're going to research cancer and I'm going to allocate this much in terms of resources towards you cancer researchers over here, this much towards those of you who are doing semiconductor research over here, right? Rather than it being centrally coordinated, coordination emerges from the bottom up with there being many formally independent centers of decision-making, right? So if we think about it within the economics profession, the Mercatus Center is one independent center of decision-making. We have teams within the Mercatus Center that also have some degree of independence. And then there are a bunch of academic economics departments. There are other think tanks. There's the National Bureau of Economic Research, right? There's all these different groups that coordinate. So that's one way of thinking about polycentricity, is that the scientific community is one example. It's one setting in which there are multiple formally independent centers of decision-making, there's cooperation, contestation, and competition among them, and then you see emergent patterns arise, right? So for instance, the formation of scientific consensus on certain topics, contestation of that scientific consensus, changes in overarching views of science, like paradigm shifts, the sort of stuff that Kuhn talks about in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, right? So you see all these emergent phenomena emerge within science. Now, Polanyi was also commenting on what's called the socialist calculation debate. So the question of whether a centrally planned economic system can essentially enable people within it to assess the costs and benefits of different production plans and guide scarce resources in production towards uses that are more highly valued by consumers. So in markets, how this operates is, again, it's a polycentric system, right? There's relatively free entry. Individuals can acquire capital, that is goods that can be used for production or potentially finances to purchase such goods. They hire workers, they pursue a project. If the project creates products and services that consumers value more than the price, then consumers are likely to buy it. And if the revenue exceeds the costs of purchasing the relevant inputs, then the firm makes a profit. If it doesn't, the firm makes a loss, and they may eventually, if they face losses enough, have to exit the market or revise their production plans. And so you have a bunch of independent centers of decision-making, a bunch of firms, as well as a bunch of independent consumers, cooperating and competing in ways that develop emergent properties, right? So emergent properties of markets might be things like there being a tendency towards for resources to flow towards the uses that are most highly valued by consumers, right? And that's an emergent property of markets that they generate that. By contrast, a system of centralized planning would involve, say, a central planning board deciding from the top down where to allocate scarce resources. And so that would be an instance of a more monocentric governmental arrangement. And we could also imagine markets under some settings being relatively more or less monocentric, right? So a situation where there's a monopoly, especially a monopoly that's protected from competitive entry, that is more monocentric than a more competitive market with free entry. And so this was sort of the initial phase of polycentricity research. And then Vincent Ostrom and Charles Thibault, and I think Robert Warren, but I could be wrong about the first name, Ostrom, Thibault, and Warren do a paper where they talk about how a similar logic applies to metropolitan areas. And so the idea here is that in a metropolitan area at the time, people were, but they wrote this right in the 60s, a lot of social reformers were looking at maps of metropolitan areas and saying, this is crazy. There's all these overlapping and competing jurisdictions. It looks like this messed up, crazy quilt. What if we consolidated all of this into a single public bureaucracy so that we could take advantage of economies of scale? The city government could set things up in a way that made sense. You didn't have all these competing different public services. And what Ostrom, Thibault, and Warren say is, okay, it looks crazy when you look at it from the top down, but it might be serving a relevant social function. So it might be the case that when you have these overlapping and competing jurisdictions, people can vote with their feet. They can move to jurisdictions that offer the bundle of public goods and services that they prefer, right? So maybe some people aren't going to use that many public services, but they would prefer to pay lower taxes. And other people are willing to pay higher taxes in order to get a more extensive bundle of publicly provided goods and services. Maybe there are some people who have different preferences about the kind of public goods services, right? So maybe some people like one kind of policing and other people like another kind. Maybe some people like one type of school and other people like another kind, right? And so if you have a bunch of different independent school districts rather than an education policy that's set all from the county level, for example, or the city level or federal level or whatever, then there's more opportunity for parents to choose what type of, which to choose to move to the places where they think have good schools, or if you implement, say, a school voucher scheme, potentially to make that choice without having to move. Similarly, if you have a bunch of different independent police precincts rather than consolidation of the police department, you're more likely to be able to move to places that offer police services that make you feel safe. You're also potentially more likely to know your local police officers, cooperate with them, build trust on a community level, and that fuels what the Ostroms called co-production. So I've mentioned Vincent Ostrom, but his wife, Eleanor Ostrom, is more famous than Vincent Ostrom is, because Eleanor Ostrom was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize in economics, mostly for her work on common pool resource governance. But her work really started a lot earlier than just the common pool resource governance stuff. She did her dissertation on water, on how municipal water management worked, and how under a sort of polycentric system of water management in California, there was room for certain types of public entrepreneurship by people who saw opportunities to influence things related to the water management policies in their area. So that was her dissertation. But then after she and Vincent moved to Indiana University in Bloomington, they had a bunch of graduate students, and they decided to pursue a research project to test some of the theories that Vincent, along with Charles Thibault, had laid out in this paper on polycentric governance of municipal areas. And they started investigating police. So they went and did ride-alongs. They did a lot of field work. They measured, they used what was called a roughometer, essentially a device that they moved along the pavement, and it would measure how bumpy it is, to test road conditions, to see sort of how reliable people's understanding of the quality of the public goods around them was. Turned out people had a pretty accurate understanding of road quality in their area, for example. Surveying and interviewing people about how well they liked the public services in their area, including the police services, going on ride-alongs with cops, as I said, to observe policing. And what they found was that in more consolidated police jurisdictions, policing quality from the perspective of the citizens was generally lower than in the more polycentric systems, suggesting that, at least at that time, there were significant benefits to polycentricity and policing insofar as citizens could vote with their feet, there were more community ties between police and community members, there was more co-production, that is, citizens who receive the good and service of security wind up contributing to producing it through being participants in and stewards of their community in that way. And so you see these significant benefits to polycentricity. And Ostrom continued to work on these types of themes in a lot of different arenas throughout her life. So her most famous work is on common pool resources. So her most famous work is a book called Governing the Commons. And so there she's critiquing, especially Garrett Hardin, as well as others influenced by him, who saw common pool resources, so a resource where you wind up being, where anyone's sort of allowed to take from it. There's not very strongly enforced, it's not that anyone's, where rather it's difficult to exclude people from taking from it, but if you take from it, it depletes, right? So think about a common fishery, for example, or grazing land where multiple farmers can graze their sheep. These are common pool resources. And the prevailing view among social scientists was, okay, this is going to get depleted because if I don't use it and I'm trying to conserve it, other people will use it up. And so then I'm just left as kind of a sucker who's the resource still gets depleted, but my herd of sheep or the amount of fish that I catch is smaller than my competitors, right? And so the fear was these will inevitably be depleted unless we either parcel them out into private plots, we privatize, or we have government come in from the top down from outside to regulate it. And what Ostrom did was she actually looked at how common pool resources had worked in a lot of contexts. And she found that in many cases, they worked pretty well without either the privatization or the top-down external government intervention. And the reason for that was there were self-governing arrangements that resource users had actually developed themselves. And so that type of common pool resource governance that's embedded within a broader system is another example of polycentric governance. And where she sort of went with this that gets particularly relevant to our paper towards the end of her life was she started applying this thinking to climate change. So you might think of climate change as precisely the sort of problem where you want a centralized monocentric solution, right? Because the fear would be, okay, if we don't get an enforceable global agreement, then if one country reduces their CO2 emissions, reduces their greenhouse gas emissions in order to contribute to climate change mitigation, then other countries can just free ride off of the climate-related benefits of that, and they still have an incentive for the well-being of their population to keep doing things that cause greenhouse gas emissions because having large amounts of energy production, for example, allows you to do a lot of things that are productive, right? And so there's incentives for other countries to free ride, and that means absent global enforcement, we are in this global collective action problem. And what Ostrom said is, okay, yeah, that's a problem, but it's really costly to develop enforceable global agreements, right? The transaction costs of negotiating with people who speak different languages, who come from wildly different cultures, in contexts where there's not a clear global enforcement mechanism, those are really high. And even in situations where there's this type of collective action problem, polycentric approaches can have benefits, in part because there's a certain bundling between these global public goods of climate change mitigation and more localized public goods, right? So maybe you don't have a incentive compatible reason to reduce CO2 emissions for climate reasons because your locality or your country is not is not going to be the decisive factor in this. And so you have a temptation to pre-write off of others, but there might be incentives to do it for reasons of reducing particulate pollution, which directly at the local level harms the health, well-being, intelligence capabilities, and so on of your local population. And so it might be the case that you can bundle those in a way that means that local collective action is possible to contribute to ways of dealing with climate change. And so she did work on the mitigation side. And of course, this doesn't just apply to governments. It applies to, you know, social movements. It applies to private groups that might contribute. They might start things like offset markets or something, right? There's a range, there's a diversity of institutional solutions and that people come up with. And so this has been applied to mitigation. It's also been in the substantial literature applied to issues of adaptation, right? How having these many different centers of decision-making can contribute to adaptation. And that's really the literature that we're contributing to with this paper, is we're saying, all right, climate change is one type of adaptation, or not climate change induced migration. Migration is one way of adapting to climate change, and it's more likely to be a welfare enhancing way of engaging in adaptation, a type of adaptation that enhances well-being when it's occurring via a set of polycentric processes than whether a monocentric top-down single center of authority gets to coercively dictate how it goes. So that's really the core of our argument, is we're applying this long-standing literature that goes back to Michael Polanyi and Friedrich Hayek, then gets further developed by Charles Tebu and Vincent Ostrom, and then by Eleanor Ostrom, and we're applying it to this particular question of migration as a form of climate change adaptation.
Mm. Yeah, clearly for something like climate migration, even though the challenge is quite complex, and even polycentric governance is not perfect, but it is definitely better than monocentric governance. I have this could be a bit of a digression, but you mm-hmm. explained about polycentric governance pertaining to things like, you know, utilities and school district and all of that. As a sidetrack, don't you think that will create more of redlining, not from a top-down point of view, but like automatic redlining? What I mean by that is richer people will move to areas that that tick their boxes, whereas the poor people are going to be there, and then the bad schools are going to become worse and the good schools are keep going to get better. What do you think on that?
So that can happen, and that's a risk that we should be aware of and should be worried about. Some reasons to think that that's not necessarily always going to be the case, or that we can, while preserving polycentricity, do things about that, are roughly as follows. One, we need to compare realistic flawed polycentric systems to realistic flawed monocentric systems. And so it might be the case that the polycentric system has these problems, but that a monocentric system generates further problems that wind up being worse, because just as wealthier people have more resources with which they can decide where to live and to purchase a home, they also have more resources with which they can decide to influence the central government, right? So they can rent seek, they can lobby, and that might result in one size fits all policies that harm those who are impoverished across the entire larger scale area, as opposed to relatively impoverished people having the autonomy to choose to develop systems that work for them, albeit maybe not quite as well as those who are relatively wealthier systems work for them. So that's one thing, is the comparative institutional point, that for all its flaws, a polycentric system may still be preferable to a monocentric system, because the problems of the disproportionate power of the wealthy are likely to be amplified in many monocentric systems rather than dampened. But the other point is that there are, one, multiple ways to set up a polycentric system. So I think you're absolutely right with regards to schooling, that that's how it's played out with our system of school districts. But it seems as though there are ways that you could increase the level of polycentricity rather than decreasing the level of polycentricity to deal with that. So for example, so-called school choice programs, such as voucher schemes, arguably are taking a system that's already polycentric in one way and making it polycentric in another way. So they're taking what is a decision that needs to come with purchasing a home in an area, which is, of course, a capitalized asset that has a high purchase price, They're taking that being the primary mechanism of funding schools, and they're saying instead, we're going to have a voucher system where everybody can be eligible to receive a certain amount of public funds, and then they can choose to apply it across jurisdictions. So in that case, if you live in a poor neighborhood, you could apply your voucher to going to a school in a rich neighborhood, right? And similarly, charter schools are arguably an increase in polycentricity, and those are also not district restricted in this way. They're not as market oriented as the voucher system because it's still something that's directly publicly funded rather than you give money to the parents that then go to the school. They're therefore constitutionally restricted to some extent from trying out some of the things like more religiously oriented education that private schools that might receive vouchers can. But in any case, you've got these school choice schemes, and I'm not saying they're perfect, but they to some extent can alleviate these problems of segregation. The other point is a polycentric system doesn't preclude the presence of a central government that does some level of redistribution. So you could have a system where you have these multiple jurisdictions, but the central government, a larger scale government, taxes and gives out, say, cash transfers or some other benefit to those that are relatively poor and poorly off. That could be one way of dealing with it. So you get the benefits of the polycentricity of social associated with local knowledge and adaptation and competitive processes playing out, but you also might want some redistribution on top of that so as to address those equity concerns that you're raising. So that would be one way to address it. So a polycentric system, there's a paper by Eleanor Ostrom called Neither Gargantua Nor Land of Lilliputs. And the idea there is, you know, the Lilliputian option, the land of Lilliputs option refers to like just total decentralization, like really small communities. And the gargantuan refers to we'll consolidate everything. And the idea here is in a polycentric system, you can have entities at multiple scales. And so maybe you have a lot of stuff handled at the local level, but you have larger scale groups that are designed to, whether they're public bureaucracies or they might be private foundations or they might be any number of other things that are aimed at providing aid to poor areas, for example, or providing scholarships there, or helping mentors from wealthier areas or with more career experiences get into the poorer performing schools or any of those types of options. So there's a wide range of things you can try that are consistent with polycentricity, and some polycentric systems are likely to perform better than others. And so we need to analyze the institutional specifics. But polycentricity certainly isn't a panacea, though I think it has significant benefits.
Yeah, that's true. And thanks for breaking it down for us, because and it's good that you mentioned the voucher program and also charter schools. Charter schools, for people who are not in the US and are not familiar with the US system, charter schools are these privately owned and operated schools, but funded with public tax dollars. You know, they have also been a point of debate. And I want to just mention about this article that came out in Forbes in 2022 by Peter Green. It says that charter schools have undermined good education policy. And they go on to say that, you know, the tension between private interests and public education has been a point of debate, but it's important that we need to find some form of a middle ground and to modify. It can't be a one size fits all solution. You know, it's also important to modify polycentric approach so that people get the best of both worlds. So, yeah, on that note, Nathan, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I think interesting discussion. You know, people talk a lot about climate change and what can be done about it, but it's important that we discuss the aspect of climate migration too, and how, you know, government policies can influence it and make the earth a better place given the circumstances. I think there is no going back now with the kind of things that we are seeing, but we can do the best we can. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight talking with you.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.